Well, I talked a little bit about this table that's in slide 3 already, which you can see is listing elements of the human body, but it's true really for just about any organism. Any given organism is mostly, in terms of atoms, made up of oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And that's because, as we'll see, nitrogen is in 2 of the 4 categories of biological macromolecules that all organisms are made out of. And carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen are in all 4 of those. So in terms of atoms, that's what we and all organisms mostly are. But there are also several other elements that a given organism requires for one reason or another, just not nearly as much. You need trace elements, trace amounts of other things. All of these elements listed, though, are from the top part of the periodic table of the elements. The periodic table of the elements is listed in order of size of atoms, and so the lightest atoms are near the top, and those are the ones that organisms contain. A lot of these things on the bottom would kill you if they were in your body. But there are some that are heavier that we need for various reasons. Anyway, though, we'll talk more about elements in a minute. Let's go to slide 4 and talk about atoms, which are building blocks of matter. All material objects in the universe are made out of atoms. And so they are building blocks, but they're really not fundamental building blocks, meaning not made up of other things, because what we can see here is that even though atoms are building blocks, they themselves, each individual atom, is made up of even smaller things called subatomic particles in general. Subatomic simply meaning below the level of the atom, smaller than an atom, just like organelles are subcellular structures. Well, even the subatomic particles that we'll study in this chapter, or in this course, if you go into other sciences, you'll realize that they're made of even smaller things, but we're not going to get into that because that's not really a biological concern, that's physics. So we're going to concern ourselves with the 3 primary subatomic particle types, which are electrons, protons, and neutrons. Some are shown, all 3 types are shown in this cartoon. This cartoon, I should say, is a lie for a couple major reasons. I'll tell you why it's a lie in a minute. First, let me say that a given atom consists of 2 regions, really. There is an atomic nucleus. That's really what defines this thing as an atom. And that's nucleus in this sense simply means core. Just don't confuse it with the other use of the exact same word. A cell nucleus is much, much bigger than an atomic nucleus. Atoms are inconceivably tiny. A single, already invisible cell has many, many millions of atoms in it. So they are truly tiny things. An atomic nucleus, though, is simply the core or the center of the atom. And it's a space, but that space is occupied by at least 1 and at most 2 of those 3 kinds of subatomic particles. Namely, the atomic nucleus for any given atom contains all of the protons that atom contains. Protons, in other words, are found only in atomic nuclei. And it's possible, depending on the atom, for there to be only protons making up the nucleus. In other words, no neutrons. But there's never any electrons in the nucleus, though. For most atoms, there are however many protons that atom has in the nucleus, plus however many neutrons that atom has in the nucleus. So, in summary, the atomic nucleus contains all of the protons and neutrons that atom has. And it contains only the protons and neutrons. It never contains the electrons. The electrons, on the other hand, make up the other region of the atom. Exterior to the nucleus, outside of the nucleus, is where the electrons are.
So atoms are smaller than regular atoms?
No, all atoms are... Well, there are atoms of different size, but the atoms making up a cell are no different from any other atoms in a non-living thing, a living thing, or a dead thing. They're all the same structural, material building blocks of all material objects. Okay, so we have electrons outside of the nucleus, some number of electrons. We have some number of protons and some number of neutrons in the nucleus. That number of protons is at least one, because if you don't have at least one proton, you don't have an atom. And the number of neutrons is zero or more. A hydrogen atom of the run-of-the-mill type doesn't have any neutrons in it. Okay, so a nucleus doesn't have to have neutrons, but it does for most atoms. Now, of these three subatomic particle types, only two of them have electrical charge, protons and electrons. The third, which are neutrons, get their name by virtue of the fact that they don't have electrical charge. They are neutral particles, therefore neutrons. All right, now I just told you that protons and neutrons are the only things found in the nucleus. Here you see two of each, two magenta-colored protons, two brown-colored neutrons. The picture holds up pretty well in this respect, meaning that protons and neutrons are almost, not identical, but almost the same mass as each other. And by the way, any individual proton is indistinguishable from any other proton, whatever atom it's in. So all protons are the same as each other. All neutrons are the same as each other. All electrons are the same as each other in the universe. Okay? Protons and neutrons are almost the same mass. The big difference, of course, is that protons are charged particles. Neutrons are not charged. And more specifically than saying protons are charged, they are positively charged, which is why each magenta proton in the cartoon has a plus on it. All right? Now, back to why this is a lie, this cartoon. It's a lie for two different reasons. One is that electrons do not orbit the nucleus in a circle. That's a lie. It's just a schematic representation of the fact that electrons are found outside of the nucleus. Where an electron is actually impossible mathematically to tell at any given moment. And why that's true is beyond the scope of this course. Just believe me on that. We can't really tell with certainty at any given moment where an electron is, but we can say that it's more likely to be in this region than this region. So saying that these electrons are exactly here and here is also a lie. Another way it's a lie, though, the overall cartoon, is that electrons are a lot more smaller than protons. Now, that's shown here as smaller, but the size difference is not correct in this figure. Electrons are much, much tinier than protons, which, of course, are already inconceivably tiny from our point of view. But electrons are... It takes many, many electrons to make up the same mass as one proton. However, electrons are also charged particles like protons. They are negatively charged, whereas protons are positively charged. Despite, though, the fact that electrons are not nearly as big as protons individually, the magnitude or the size of the charge of an electron is identical to the magnitude of the charge of a proton, just in the opposite direction. In other words, each proton is a full positive one charge, or carries a full positive one charge, And each comparatively tiny electron, despite it being so small, carries a full negative one charge. And that negative one charge of an electron completely counteracts the positive one charge of a much bigger proton. Okay, now, this is why we can say that an atom overall doesn't have charge, even though it's made up of charged particles, protons and electrons. What we mean when we say the word atom is really neutral atom. Okay? An atom is neutral electrically only if the number of electrons it has is the same as the number of protons it has. Since they're equal in magnitude but opposite in charge, the same number of positives plus the same number of negatives adds up to zero. Zero overall charge for the whole atom. Okay, so an atom, when we use that word, properly refers only to particles in which the number of electrons equals the number of protons. That's not true for all particles, but that's what, if it is true, then we use the word atom. And this is an atom because two protons, two electrons, they counteract each other electrically. Neutrons don't contribute to the overall charge because they are neutral, whether there's zero or some positive number of them. They do contribute to the mass of the atom, though. They just don't add any charge one way or the other. Okay, now, in slide 5, we see the same picture repeated in B. A is still a lie, but it's not as bad a lie. It's better at representing the truth because it doesn't show individual atoms at specific or electrons at specific places. I just told you that it's impossible to tell that. So what we have here is a yellow cloud of varying yellowness is what's called mathematically a probability density, meaning that the more yellow it is here, the more likely it is for an electron to be there than somewhere where it's less yellow. We just don't know with certainty where. All right, and they're moving. I mean, they don't stay in a position. They're somewhere in this cloud, this electron cloud that's depicted by the yellowness. Okay, now we need to talk about some spaces, starting with slide 6. These things I'm going to describe are spaces, which means they're not material. They're not made out of particles. All right, like this room is a space. We are in the space. But notice that you could take this overall space, the whole room, and subdivide it mentally, conceptually, into smaller subspaces, right? Like each desk is occupying its own subspace compared to the other subspaces. But they're all part of the overall space. And each desk, which is already a subspace, could be subdivided into two subspaces representing each chair, right? They're still not materials, they're just spaces within spaces within spaces. And that's true for atoms as well. When it comes to the place where electrons might be found, which is outside of the nucleus, there's three levels of space. I shouldn't say the word level here because that's going to confuse things. There's three sizes of spaces, basically. Okay? The first of those is represented by slide 6, and these spaces are called energy levels by one of their names. You can call them energy levels. You can also call them electron shells or just shells. All of those words are interchangeable. They mean exactly the same thing. Shell, energy, level, or electron shell. Okay? Just different phrases for the same thing. And it's not a material object. It's just a space around the nucleus. Well, we call these levels, we number the levels, starting with 1, which is the closest one to the nucleus itself, and then level 2 farther away, level 3 farther away still, and so on. Electrons can occupy levels, which are, remember, the levels are just the spaces. But importantly, for this slide, an electron is either in a level or it's in another level. It's never between levels. That's what's represented by the analogy of the ball bouncing down the stairs. If you conduct this experiment, you can do it as many times as you want, and I'm going to tell you that the ball is never going to stop halfway down a step. Now, it could land on any individual step, right? It might go all the way down, which is the final step in this example, but it's going to be at one exact level or another, never between. Similarly for electrons, they're either in shell 1 or in shell 2 or in shell 3 and so on. Well, shell 1, being closest to the nucleus, is the lowest energy shell, meaning that electrons are at the lowest energy when they are in that first shell, which is what any given electron wants to be. They're attracted, since they're negative, to the positively charged nucleus, because opposite electrostatic charges attract each other. And therefore, they want to be as close to the nucleus as possible. But there's a limit to how many electrons these spaces can contain at one time. All right? What's represented by the arrows, though, is that electrons can jump up a level or jump down a level in whole numbers, though, not fractional levels. It's going to take energy, though, being delivered to the atom to cause an electron to go up an energy level. And if it comes back down, then energy will be released by that electron. I mean by that atom. Sorry. Okay? Those are shells, or energy levels, or just levels. And that's the biggest of the space types. Now, we're going to subdivide the levels, which are already spaces, into subspaces. And I can go to slide 7 to start talking about this, but I'm really not talking about anything specifically on the slide yet. An individual level, which is a space, is subdivided into what are called subshells. Right? It's only part of a shell, just like a subset is part of a set, mathematically. Subshells, then, are subdivided into smaller spaces called orbitals. Now, all three of them are simply spaces that electrons can be, but they have different names for good reason. Okay, now, notice the smallest of those spaces I just told you about are the orbitals. There are different kinds of orbitals that I'll talk about in a minute. But regardless of the type of orbital, an individual orbital can contain at most two electrons. Sorry. Okay? That means in terms of the number of electrons, there's three possibilities for an orbital, for an individual orbital. It's either zero, it's empty, zero electrons, one electron, half filled, or two electrons are in that orbital, full. No other possibilities. Okay? Now, the reason that subshells are called subshells is because they are spaces made up of all of the same type of orbitals within that shell. Okay, so you have the cell divided into subshells, each of which is divided into orbitals. But a subshell contains only one kind of orbital. There might be more than one of those orbitals, but they're the same kind. What we see in this cartoon is different orbitals, not only different individual orbitals, but this represents different kinds of orbitals as well. Every shell, meaning levels 1 and up, features an S-type orbital. You can think of S as meaning sphere, if you want. That's not why they chose S. But in shape, in terms of the shape of the space, S orbitals are spherical. So this is supposed to be three-dimensional. These aren't circles, they're spheres. These two. Notice the darker one and the lighter one are both spherical. They are both s orbitals. However, they are in different levels. There's two levels represented here. Energy level 1 or shell 1 and shell 2. If we showed shell 3, there would be an even bigger sphere. That would be the s orbital that's in that shell. All right, everyone clear on that? So every level features an S-type orbital and exactly one orbital in that shell. There's only one S orbital in each shell. Therefore, the S subshell, which is the collection of all the S orbitals in the same shell, is really the same thing as the S orbital because there's only one of them. Okay? Starting with level 2, though, and above, in addition to having an S orbital, making up the S subshell, there's also a P subshell in those second and higher levels. Each P subshell contains all of the P orbitals that are in that shell. Since there aren't any P orbitals in the first shell, then that means there is no P subshell in the first shell. And therefore, in the special case of the first shell, the first S orbital, which we call the 1S, in this case the 1 refers to the shell number, so this smaller sphere is the 1S orbital. The 1S orbital, the first shell's S subshell, and the first shell overall are really the same thing. Because that one space, the shell, consists of just one subshell, which is the whole shell, the S subshell, and that subshell contains only one of the S orbitals it contains, because each level contains only one S orbital in it. Now, is that all clear? This small circle, in other words, represents the S orbital. It also represents the S subshell in the first shell. And it represents the entire first shell.
And the second one is a P?
Well, the second shell has its own S subshell consisting of all the S orbitals that are in that shell. But I told you that each shell has only one S orbital in that in its own subshell. So this bigger circle represents not the whole second shell, but the second S subshell. And it also, coincidentally, represents the 2S orbital, the S orbital that's in the second shell. Because the subshell, for S subshells, there's only one orbital in each one. Okay?
So those first three levels you're talking about are in that one first...
There's only two levels represented here, but go on.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that the three levels you were talking about before were in that one shell.
No, this by level, you mean energy level.
Correct, yes.
There's only two energy levels in this picture. Okay, now... Starting with the second, I said that there's, in addition to an S subshell in levels 2, 3, and above, there is also a P subshell in levels 2, 3, and above. Each P subshell contains all of the P orbitals that are in that shell. But unlike S subshells, a P subshell contains three different P orbitals. All in the same shell. And P orbitals are not spherical. They are dumbbell in shape. Kind of like an infinity symbol, but in three dimensions. And so this is a single P orbital. This is a single P orbital. And this is a single P orbital. Now this is in two dimensions, but you should imagine this as in three dimensions. And each of these individual P orbitals is arranged mutually orthogonally with the others, which simply means that it's at right angles to each of the other two. So these correspond to the x, y, and z axes of a three-dimensional space. Yeah.
Are you able able to, just so that we, because I'm having a hard time visualizing, are you able to separate each one of those so it's not all together?
The next slide does exactly that. So you'll like the next slide, hopefully. Okay, but the point here is that what makes a P subshell is that all of those components of the subshell are in the same shell, but the subshell itself is made up of only the orbitals of that type. There's two types of orbitals in the second shell, S orbitals and P orbitals. Well, there's only one S orbital, so it makes up the entire S subshell of that shell. There are three different P orbitals, though. Those are individual orbitals, but you combine all three of them into the one subshell that the P orbitals make up. Okay? And when you combine the P subshell and the S subshell of shell 2, that's the entire shell 2. So the shell is made up of subshells, each of which is made up of orbitals. Okay, now let's go to the next slide where they are separated. Here you have the first shell, which I said is the same thing, really, as the first S subshell, which is the same thing as the first S orbital. They all are the same space. It's like having a set with only one element, right? If you have a set, the letter F is the element in the set. Well, the set containing F is not only the whole set, it's also a subset of that, right? A subset can be the entire set. On the other hand, when we go to shell 2, there are two subshells within it. Each shell has its own S subshell consisting of one S orbital. I mean, a single S orbital. I shouldn't say one S. This S orbital is called the 2S orbital because it's in the second shell. Right? It's a bigger sphere than the 1S orbital. But anyway, there's only one S making up the entire subshell within that level. The other subshell, though, is the P subshell containing all three of the P orbitals in that shell. All right, now, so how many orbitals are in the second shell?
Four
orbitals. A single S, namely the 2S, and three different P orbitals, which we call 2P, but since there's three of them, we call them 2PX, 2PY, and 2PZ to represent the fact that they're mutually orthogonal, XYZ axes. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay, now what did I say is important about any individual orbital, regardless of its type? Yeah, what did I say is true of any individual orbital regardless of type or where it is? I said that any individual orbital can contain at most two electrons. That's not true for just S's. It's true for P's. And if we go to the third level, we have D's, which we're not going to get into in this course, but D's and F orbitals are different types with different shapes. All right? But it doesn't matter what kind it is. An individual orbital is either empty, zero electrons, half filled, one electron, or filled, two electrons. All right, with that in mind, how many electrons can the first shell contain? Two, because that whole shell consists of only one subshell, which itself consists of only one orbital, namely the 1s orbital. And if you get two electrons in there, the entire shell is filled because it only has one orbital. Now, what about second shell?
Up to eight
electrons, because there are four individual orbitals, right? There's the 2s orbital, plus three different P orbitals, two P orbitals. Each can contain at most two electrons, therefore the entire shell, shell 2, can contain at most eight electrons. And that is the basis in chemistry for the so-called octet rule. Okay? But let's look at the periodic table of the elements, which is a listing of all elements in the universe that we know of, or that we have created so far. Before I get to this point about the space, back to this point about the spaces, let's just say something about being an element. Each element is made up of only one kind of atom. You know, like a titanium sample, if it's pure, every atom is a titanium atom as opposed to atom of any other element. Now, I told you earlier that all electrons are indistinguishable, all protons are indistinguishable, all neutrons are indistinguishable. So different types of atoms making up the different elements are made of the same subatomic particles. But there is one thing and only one thing that makes any given atom an atom of that type, an atom of that element. And that is how many protons are in its nucleus. That's the only thing that makes an atom that atom type. Hydrogen is the simplest atom because it has just one proton. If you don't have a proton, then you're not an atom. So it's the simplest possibility. It's just a single proton. And the fact that it has exactly one proton is the only thing that makes it a hydrogen atom. The number of neutrons, which can be zero or more, meaningless as far as being hydrogen. The number of electrons, meaningless as far as being hydrogen. Only the number of protons matters. And that number of protons is indicated by the blue number on this version, which is called the atomic number. For any individual atom, the atomic number is simply the number of protons that are in the nucleus. Okay? Now, if we're talking about neutral atoms, which we are when we say the word atom, then whatever the number of protons is, which depends on the element, you also have the same number of electrons, right? Okay, now we can get back to these spaces. The periodic table is a table, obviously, and usually we talk about rows and columns, but we don't use those words for the periodic table. We have different names for rows and columns. What are the rows named? What are they called, I mean? Instead of rows, they're called periods. Because they repeat. That's what makes it periodic. It repeats. Characteristics of these atoms repeat each row. But each row is not only called a period, structurally speaking or atomically speaking, each row or period represents an energy level or a shell. That's why they're numbered 1, 2, 3, and above along the left-hand side of this. Okay, now, why is it that the first period contains only two elements on the table? Why this big gap? Yeah?
Because you can only have two electrons in the first shell.
It is true that you can only hold two electrons in the first shell, and why is that true? Because the first shell contains only one total orbital, namely the 1s orbital. There aren't any other orbitals in the shell. And since I told you any individual orbital can contain at most two electrons, that means the entire first shell can hold 0, 1, or 2 electrons, and that's it. All right? Hydrogen is hydrogen because it has one proton. But it's a neutral hydrogen atom if it has, therefore, also one electron to counteract the positive charge of the proton. That's one electron that can fit in the one orbital that's in this shell.
Is that always the case, or is it sometimes different?
No, that's always the case. Okay. Now, helium is helium for only one reason. There are two protons in its nucleus, right? But if it's a neutral atom, then there are two electrons as well. And therefore, that second electron can also occupy this one orbital that's in the entire first shell, but that's it. That fills it up. right? That's why there are no more elements in that first period. Because the first shell can't hold any more than two electrons. All right? The fact that they're separated from each other doesn't mean anything chemically. There's two overall in that period, though. Now, lithium, number three, is lithium only because it has three protons. Once again, it's a neutral atom if it has the same number of electrons. So there's three electrons. The first two of those fill up the first shell. There's a third electron, though, right? And it can't go in that first shell. That's why lithium is bumped down into the second period, representing the second shell. And that second shell for lithium contains only one electron. But how many electrons can be in that second shell? Eight, because there are four different orbitals in that second shell. There's the 2s, which can hold two of its own. There's the 2px, the 2py, and the 2pz, each of which can hold two of its own, for a total of eight possible electrons in the second shell. Notice that helium and neon are right at the edge, and anything in that column, by the way, I didn't say what columns are called in the periodic table, they're called groups. And whatever the members are of a group, they have very similar chemical properties. So neon, helium, argon, those are similar chemically. What is noticeable about all of those, though, is that they are right at the right edge. They collectively, as a group, are called the noble gases because they are very stable just as individual atoms. The reason they have this stability and the reason they're represented at the right edge is because their outer shell is full of electrons. A fullness of an outer shell, or more correctly, an outer subshell, gives that atom high stability. So the noble gases, as atoms, don't want to interact with anyone else. Not other kinds of atoms, not even other atoms of the same kind. And therefore, under ordinary circumstances, they don't undergo chemical reactions. They're inert, which means they just are happy being their kind of atom with that high stability. Everything else to the left of the right edge is at least partially unhappy with respect to having an outer subshell that's filled. Okay? And as we'll see, chemistry or chemical reactions, which is a big part of chemistry, is really all about rearranging electrons so that individual atoms can be closer to that right edge in terms of stability. Okay. The top part of this figure, notice, show these yellow rings. These yellow rings are not orbitals. How do you know they can't possibly be orbitals? Well, other than the fact that they're labeled as shells, which they are. But if they weren't labeled, how would you know that they can't possibly be representing orbitals? Well, orbitals can have electrons, but you're close. That is a truth, but it's not what makes them impossible to denote orbitals. What is it that makes it impossible for these to be orbitals, these yellow rings? That's, I can see what you're saying there, too, because different orbitals have different shapes. But it's simply the fact that there's more than two electrons in this space, so it can't possibly be an orbital, right? So each yellow ring represents a shell, which is made up of some number of subshells, which is made up of some number of orbitals. But notice the first shell has only two electrons in it. That's because that completely fills the only orbital that shell has. These two electrons in the second shell, these two, and these two, are paired up because each pair is filling up one of the four orbitals that are in that second shell. Okay. Well, on slide 9, we have an abbreviated version of the periodic table. It's only the ones near the top, the elements near the top, which is what organisms are mostly made out of. But you have this notion of shells being represented by these yellow circles. And here we can really just put to pictures what I've already said in words. The reason that the first period has only two is that because once you put two electrons in there, which helium has, you're done with that first shell. But lithium has to put its third electron somewhere. Well, it puts it into the second shell, which can hold up to 8, which is why there are 8 elements in that second period. All right, now another thing, before I get to the actual substance of slide 10, let me talk a little bit more about the periodic table. 100 or so naturally occurring elements, but they're divided into two major groups, the metals and the nonmetals. And most elements are metals. Now, a lot of versions of the periodic table, not this one, but many of them, will have kind of a stair step going diagonally right here, which divides the nonmetals in the upper right corner, which are these relatively small number of atoms or elements, from the nonmetals, which is everything to the left of that stair step. So there's far more metals than there are nonmetals, as far as elements are concerned. Now, think about these spaces that we've been talking about. Metals are on the left. And things that are situated on the left side of the periodic table, as the metals are, have an outer subshell that is more empty than full. That's represented also in slide 9. Right, these ones on the left, this outer shell has a small number in it. It's more empty than it is full. Whereas the ones toward the right hand are more full than empty. Okay, remember that being full gives you very high stability, like the noble gases. And that's what everything is really trying to achieve in chemical reactions. But if we think of a metal like sodium in this example. This example in slide 10, by the way, is exactly the same chemical reaction that we started with. Sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride. That's why there's a chemical reaction indicating arrow here. But the reaction is not the point here. The point is that ions are forming. Anyway, the example involves sodium. Number 11. Number 11 means it has 11 protons, therefore 11 electrons, right? The first two fill up shell 1. The next 8 fill up shell 2. There's still one left, which is why it involves a third shell. We only call shells if there's at least one electron in it. We don't. It has, theoretically, a fourth shell, but it's empty. Anyway, you see that it had to put it somewhere, but that third shell is nowhere near full. And that's true for metals in general. Their outer shell is mostly empty, more empty than full. Well, this brings up a potentially confusing word, valence. Potentially confusing because it's used 3 different ways. Okay, one way is to use it in the phrase the valence shell or the valence subshell. In this use of the word, it's referring to the shell or subshell that is the outermost one containing at least an electron. We don't count empty ones, totally empty ones, right? So the valence shell or the valence subshell is simply the outermost shell or subshell that has at least one electron in it. That's one use of the word in that phrase. We can also talk about an atom's number of valence electrons. Valence electrons are simply any electrons that are in that valence shell or subshell. All right? And the number of valence electrons is simply however many there are in that valence shell. So if we look at, for instance, nitrogen, how many valence electrons does nitrogen have? Yes, it has five. Seven overall electrons to counteract its seven protons, right? Two of those, though, are not valence electrons because they're in the inner shell, shell one. The outer shell that contains at least one electron is shell two in this case. And that has the rest, the other five that make up its seven total. So the number of valence electrons for nitrogen is five. Everyone clear on that? The confusing part comes in on the third use of the term, which is just valence by itself. An atom's valence is the number of additional electrons you would have to give it in order to fill its valence shell or subshell.
Say that one more time, please.
Yes, the valence is the number of additional electrons required to fill the valence subshell. Now, based on that definition, what is the valence of nitrogen? It's three. It has five valence electrons, which is three short of having the eight required to fill that shell. The valence shell is the second shell. You see the difference? Now, if we use hydrogen for an example, and by the way, I don't think I mentioned this. Hydrogen, even though it's all the way over there on the left, is a non-metal. It's the only non-metal that's on its own like that. All the others on the left are metals. But if we use hydrogen as an example, what is the number of valence electrons?
One,
which is also the number of electrons. It only has one electron. And what is its valence? Also one, just coincidentally. And that's because that shell that is the valence shell for hydrogen is the first shell, and it can only hold two. So there's no octet rule for the first period. Second period, yes, but not the first period. So it's halfway filled. All right, and that's just coincidence that the number of valence electrons equals the valence. Same coincidence happens with carbon, by the way. Carbon has six overall electrons, two of which are in the first shell. That means it has four valence electrons, right? But it also has a valence of four because it needs four more to add to those four to get to eight. Another way you can think of the valence, by the way, a practical way, is to look at how many steps from the right edge it is. Notice that carbon is four steps away from neon, which is nice and happy. That's what atoms are individually trying to achieve, the stability of the right edge, the noble gases. All right?
Can you use that all the way down the chart?
Yeah, but we're going to ignore most of this stuff. It is true that the farther you get down, the more exceptions there are to the simple way I'm putting things compared to how, if you got deeply into it, there would be exceptions.
So every shell past the first shell.
No, but that's true for the second, and this is why I'm saying subshell instead of shell, because the third shell actually has three subshells. But that's where there are exceptions that get involved. I'm not going to get into it, but it's exactly eight for the second shell. The third shell obeys the octet rule simply because that has a complete subshell, where as opposed to an entire shell that's filled. All right? I don't want to get... It's complicated enough as it is. I don't want to get into the exceptions down at the bottom of the periodic table because you can learn that in a chemistry course. Okay, but yes, think of it practically as the number of steps to get to the right edge. And notice that the metals are far from the right edge. You can think of sodium, which is what's in this example, as being on the left edge simply because it's one away from neon before it, which is on the right edge, right? Which is just another way of saying that its outer, its valence subshell is almost empty. It contains just the one additional electron that it had to put in that shell. So metals in general have a valence shell that's more empty than full. Metals, nonmetals, on the other hand, have a valence shell that are more full than empty. And the reason that's important is that if you have ionization occurring, then metals are going to ionize differently from how nonmetals ionize based on this notion of whether they are more full or more empty. But first, let's get this word ion out of the way. An ion is a charged particle, and it can be made up of one or more atoms, but here we're talking about monatomic ions. An ion is charged, though, so it's not an atom, because atom means neutral. Now, strictly speaking, it is an atom. It's made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons, but we don't call it an atom if it's not neutral. If you think about not being neutral, that could be achieved four different ways, really, right? Because all you have to do is have the number of protons not equal the number of electrons in order for it to have a charge. Because only if they are equal will it add up to zero. So there's four ways you could think about that happening. You could add protons, you could subtract protons, you could add electrons, or you could subtract electrons. Any one of those four would get you to the situation in which the number of protons does not equal the number of electrons, right? But that only two of those ways are the ways in which ions form. Ions don't form by messing with the number of protons. If you change the number of protons, that's not a chemical reaction that's occurring. That's a change in elements, right? You change the number of protons, by definition, you no longer have the same kind of element. So this happens, for instance, in radioactive decay. Well, that's not what we're talking about here. In normal chemical reactions, the protons stay put in whatever nucleus they are in to begin with. So adding protons and subtracting protons are out, even though those theoretically make sense for forming an ion. That's not how it happens. There are two ways that ions form, either by taking on additional electrons, one or more, or by losing electrons, one or more. Okay? The number of positives stays the same. The number of negatives becomes greater or less than the number of positives. And since there's two ways for that to happen, taking on electrons or removing electrons, we subcategorize the group of particles called ions into two types of ions, which are anions and cations. Now, this an and cat, these prefaces, you see in various words, like cathode and anode, electrically speaking, for instance. They're opposites of each other, though. In biology, there are such things as anadromous fish, which swim one way upstream to have their young, and catadromous fish, which swim downstream to spawn. So one means up, the other one means down. But in terms of ions, anions are negatively charged ions, and cations are positively charged ions. And think about this difference between metals and nonmetals with respect to emptiness. A metal, being on the left side, is more empty in its valence shell than full, right? So sodium, for instance, would like to get to either argon or neon. Either one is stable, right? But it's a hell of a lot easier to get like neon by simply losing the one electron that counts this shell as a shell, right? Losing that one electron will mean it only has the two shells now, and that second one is already full. Whereas getting like argon would mean it would have to take on seven additional electrons. It's a hell of a lot easier to lose a small number than it is to gain a bigger number. But just the opposite for nonmetals. They're close to being full, so it's easier for them to take on a small number of electrons rather than lose a bigger number of electrons. Both ways, though, both species, the metal and the nonmetal, will get more stable if they get to a situation that's like one of the noble gases. So this is why this number of valence electrons is an important concept. We have here sodium metal, which is a neutral atom, and chlorine nonmetal, also a neutral atom to begin with, that when they come into contact are seemingly made for each other. Because the sodium, as you can see by the shell representation, only has one in its valence shell. It wants to get rid of it because then we won't even count this shell, and the second shell will be its new valence shell, and that's already full. Just like neon. Okay? Chlorine gas, on the other hand, or chlorine atom, on the other hand, has a third shell that's almost full. So it will gladly take the one that sodium is trying to get rid of and add it to its valence shell to make it as stable as argon on the right edge. Metals, in general, form cations by losing electrons. And make sure you have it straight in your mind that losing an electron is going to make you positive, right? Because you still have the same number of positive protons. If you now have one fewer negative, because you've lost an electron, the total is a positive number. Does that make sense? The loss of electrons makes for a positive ion, and that's what metals do. Nonmetals take on electrons to form anions, negatively charged, because taking on additional electrons means you still have the same number of positives, but now you have an even greater number of negatives, and therefore adding them up means you're going to be a negative number overall charge. Yeah?
So then, for elements like carbon and silicon, they're both far away, losing and gaining?
Yes, they're halfway between. And as a matter of fact, carbon especially of those, that's called tetravalence, and I'm actually going to talk about why that's so special in a different chapter. But you're right about that. It's right in the middle. And that's kind of why the things that are on that diagonal line they're called semiconductors. They're between metals and nonmetals, really. But officially, carbon is a nonmetal. Okay? And boron, right beside it, is a metal. But you are right that it's four, so it's in the middle. I guess it's an exception to what I said, that it's more full than empty. I mean, more empty than full. It's equally full and empty. It's still, though, I'm glad you brought this up, because when we have an ionic bond form, and that's really another major point of this slide, you see here the formation of one kind of chemical bond. There are different kinds of chemical bonds, and there are also bonds that aren't even chemical bonds. Bonds are forces of attraction, though. A chemical bond is any bond that, when formed, produces new substance. And that's true here, right? When this reaction occurs, you no longer have sodium, you no longer have chlorine, you have a new substance called sodium chloride that isn't like sodium and it's not like chlorine either. Not all bonds do that, as we'll see later. But an ionic bond does that. And that new substance, since in this case it's made out of different kinds of elements, is called a compound. That's what compounds are. Combinations of elements. There's different ways of doing that as well, but you can form a compound in a reaction that forms an ionic bond. Any ionic bond is called ionic because it involves two ions. So there's a transfer of an electron here, in this case one electron. It doesn't have to be exactly one electron that's transferred. But in general, in an ionic bond formation, There is a transfer of electrons from one atom to the other. This happens for a reaction between a metal and a nonmetal. In this example, the metal is sodium and the nonmetal is chlorine. But in general, a metal reacting with a nonmetal is going to involve a transfer of electrons, more or less permanent transfer, from one to the other, forming simultaneously two different ions, right? Because the thing that loses the electron is going to become an ion. The thing that gains the electron is going to also become an ion. There are different types of ions, though. Metals want to give up electrons, so they become positively charged ions called cations. Metals do. The nonmetal in the reaction wants to take on additional electrons. That's going to make them negatively charged, which makes them anions. But that single transfer of an electron from one to the other simultaneously produces two ions, right? An anion and a cation. They have opposite charges with respect to each other. And that is why they are attracted to each other. There is an electrostatic attraction between unlike charges. So a cation is attracted to an anion because they're oppositely charged. That's what holds the two ions together in an ionic bond. The transfer is done. The electron is now the property of the chloride ion. But that leaves the chloride negatively charged and it leaves the sodium positively charged, and that's what holds them together, the opposite charges. Is that clear? That's enough of a strong charge. I mean, it's a strong enough attraction that it makes new stuff with new properties. That's why it's a chemical bond. We'll talk about weaker bonds that aren't chemical bonds later. But this is a chemical bond. Despite being a chemical bond strong enough to make new substance, it is the weakest kind of chemical bond. There's not all that much force of attraction between the two, but it's enough. All right? That's always going to be between a metal and a nonmetal. Go ahead.
So then can sodium form a bond with a different element like sulfur?
Yes, any metal can match up with some number of any nonmetals.
Okay, but then the sulfur atom wouldn't have enough electrons to...
That's why I said any number.
Okay.
And this is why, for instance, if you have magnesium, which needs to get rid of two electrons to be happy, it will have to give those two... one individually to each of two chlorines to make them chlorides. And that's why it'll be MgCl2. It takes two chlorines to react with one magnesium to make everyone happy. Okay, that was a good question. Now, the ionic bond is significant because it's a chemical bond, but like I said, it's the weakest one of the chemical bonds, and therefore... it's pretty easy to break it compared to other chemical bonds. In the next slide, before we get to the other kinds of chemical bonds, though, let me show you that unlike the previous slide, which involved just a single sodium and a single chlorine atom, which is effectively never the case, right? Even in a tiny sample, there are trillions of both types of atoms. So when you have the point here is that when ionization occurs, when the sodium becomes positively charged and the chloride becomes negatively charged, they're not attracted to just each other only. When the chloride becomes negatively charged, it looks negative in all directions to all positive particles. So positive particles are attracted to it from all directions. And just the opposite for a positively charged particle. It attracts negatives from all directions. That's why if you have a bunch of both types, sodium and chloride, they won't just form these two ion structures. They'll form a clump, a crystal that's indefinitely big as you have enough ions for. When people mine salt to sell as table salt, there are crystals that are much bigger than buildings. It's all one chunk of substance. And that is not... These are salts, by the way. They're called ionic compounds, and another name for an ionic compound is a salt. It's simply a compound formed when an ionic bond is holding them together. And that occurs between a metal and a nonmetal. That's how you get salts. But there are no molecules of salt. Molecule is a special word that we don't use to describe ionic compounds or salts. That's because there is no definite size. Molecules have definite size. There is no definite size to a piece of salt. It's as big or as small as you want. There is a lower limit. There's no upper limit. But of course, for sodium chloride, as an example, the bare minimum is that you have to have one sodium and one chlorine, right? Or one chloride. We don't call that a molecule, though. The smallest piece of a salt that you can have is called a formula unit. Which, you know, when you were talking about what you said, for a formula, the formula unit for magnesium chloride would be one magnesium and two chlorides, the bare minimum. Because if you have fewer than that, you no longer have the substance. The smallest piece of a salt that you can have. But there's no upper limit to how big a piece. Okay, that's one type of compound, or one type of chemical bond. Now we can go to 12 and talk about the second category, which is covalent bonds. And remember I said that ionic bonds are formed between a metal and a nonmetal? A covalent bond is formed between two nonmetals. Not necessarily two different ones either. In this case, the two nonmetals are two of the same nonmetal. They're both hydrogen. And remember, hydrogen is a nonmetal even though it's on the left edge. Okay, so covalent bonds really use only these relatively few nonmetals, the ones in the upper right corner plus hydrogen. But there's a hell of a lot of different ways you can combine those relatively few atoms, which is why there are so many different kinds of molecules. I said that salts don't form molecules. Well, nonmetals, when they form covalent bonds, what are formed are called molecules properly. And the difference here is that a molecule has a defined size, which will become clear as we go through the slide from top to bottom. Here it's really important to remember what valence means. Hydrogen has one valence electron, as we said, but more importantly, it also has a valence of one, right? It needs one more electron to be as happy as helium, because that will fill the shell, its valence shell, which is shell one. It has only one electron, though, so it's not there by itself, as an atom. Well, it's not going... Each of these two hydrogen atoms is in exactly the same situation as in terms of what it wants, right? Each one wants an additional electron. Therefore, it's not going to be a transfer of electron, because one of them's not going to stand for that deal, right? They both would like an additional electron. But no electrons are created in chemical reactions. There's no addition or subtraction of material, of subatomic particles. It's just a rearrangement. So there are, when you talk about these two atoms, two total electrons to work with, right? That's why there's not going to be a transfer, and therefore there's not going to be an ionization. There's not going to be an ionic bond forming here. Instead, they more or less make a deal with each other, in which each one says, I will share my one electron with you if you share your one electron with me. And even though there are two total electrons, if those two electrons are shared by both atomic nuclei, the two atoms, then each individual atom gets credit for both of them. And in terms of stability, it will seem, it will increase the stability of each of those two atoms. Each one will be as though it has those two electrons to itself. It gets credit for both because those two electrons that are shared spend some time around each of those two electrons, just not permanently. So a covalent bond is not a transfer of an electron or more. Rather, it's sharing pairs of electrons. And the word pairs here is important. Notice in the previous example, which was an ionic bond formation, there was a transfer of a single electron because that's what made those particular types of atoms happy. In a covalent bond, it's never one electron that's involved because it's a sharing of electrons mutually. Both atoms contribute an electron to the sharing deal. So a single covalent bond is made up of two electrons, one pair, but two electrons total, one from each of the two atoms involved. All right? We can see their electron clouds merging, and now the two electrons that are there are spending time around each of them. Where they are at any given moment, we don't know, but they're spending equal time, basically, between both. And that's why each atom gets the stability that it would get if it had those electrons to itself permanently.
That's just in regards to hydrogen, though, correct? If we pick something else that had more electrons?
Well, if you pick two nonmetals, like a carbon and an oxygen, for instance, or a carbon and a hydrogen, any two nonmetals could do the same thing.
There's going to be more electrons floating around within
this. I see what you're saying. In this case, the only electrons that are there are shared. But in other cases where you have, for instance, carbon, it has its valence shell is number two, right? Well, the two electrons that it has in its first shell are not going to be involved in sharing. Those are going to stay the property, permanent property of that carbon. But its valence electrons might or might not be shared with others. And by the way, this brings up the notion that it should make sense to you that in a chemical reaction, it's not the nuclei that are rearranging. It's the electrons. Chemical reactions are rearrangements of electrons, which should make sense because when two atoms meet, it's not their nuclei that meet. It's the outer parts of them, right, that meet, which are the electron clouds. That's what gets rearranged in chemical reactions. And that's why you still have the same kinds of atoms in terms of elements, like water forming out of hydrogen and oxygen. Water still is made up of hydrogen and oxygen because those protons are still where they were originally. But it's a rearrangement of electrons. Okay, so this is properly called a molecule, an H2 molecule, which is different from a salt because it does have a definite size. Yes, you can have trillions and trillions of these in even a small sample of hydrogen gas, but each molecule is not interacting with the other molecules. See how that's different from a salt? The salt can be as big as you want where they're all interacting with each other because they're all connected by ionic bonds. Here you have one covalent bond between two hydrogen atoms, and they don't want to have any sharing deal with any other hydrogen atoms. That one molecule is a molecule by itself, and there are other molecules bouncing off of it, but they're not interacting. So we use molecule only to refer to particles that are made by covalent bonds. And they can be elements, like this is, you're going from monatomic elements, one atom, to a diatomic element, two atoms here, but it's still an element because it's nothing but hydrogen. You can also, though, form covalent bonds between two dissimilar nonmetals, like carbon and oxygen, to form carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide. Those are also molecules because they're formed by covalent bonds. They're not salts. Salts are metals and nonmetals. All right. Oh, I better stop. See you Wednesday.